Good to see everyone. Great to be here. So our passage this morning is from Acts verse 16 to 34. But before I read that, I'm just going to get you time. If you have Bibles and you do want to find it in your Bible, you can do so. Also, there's three, Prosper packed them out nicely, so there's three Bibles at the back. And that is the only translation, the ESV. They actually translated the Greek from that. So use that Bible if you have an option. Before we get into that, I just want to recap. We're busy with the life of Paul, and for the last 3 weeks, we've been in it. We started off with Hanyu, just giving us the beginnings of Paul's life, and he spoke on the zeal that Paul has, the reason why he's so zealous to purify the Jewish truth. To such an extent, that word is directly equated to violence. Basically, Paul killed people that weren't Jewish, and especially who claimed to be Jewish, the Christians, and then his conversion, and then after that, the beginnings of his ministry. Solvan led us into that, and specifically his relationship with Barnabas and his first church plant in Antioch, and just the role that encouragement played for Paul, and that encouragement that he actually took forward. From there, Johan took us in broad strokes into Paul's first missionary journey, and he went into Galatia, and that's kind of where we pick up today. So Paul returns from that missions journey. He's called back to Jerusalem because they have a council. Johan explains so nicely this tension that the Christian truth is no longer just for Jews. It's now also for the Gentiles. And so they sort that out in Jerusalem. And from there, Paul now heads out again. And this is his second missionary journey. So he heads in further west, further into Europe. And he goes through Philippi, he gets imprisoned there, that's the first instance we have of that. A lot of persecution from both Jews and Gentiles. And then he ends up in Athens, and that is where my story falls in. So we skipped through a lot, and actually such a beautiful book, so I encourage you to just go right back into Acts and read it like 20 times. It's such an encouragement. Of the life that we actually now have. We're in Acts 29. There's only 28 chapters, and the 29th chapter is our lives. We're actually supposed to live out this mission. So we are in Athens. Let's read the text. We're in chapter 17, verse 16 to 34. Now, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities," because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring strange things, some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all of the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling and hearing new things, or something new. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with an inscription to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as through he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, "We will hear you again about this." So Paul went out from their midst. But some men joined him and believed, among whom was Dionysius, the Areopagite, and the woman named Damaris, and the others with him. So that is our text. And the reason why we stop at Acts is Acts was actually a very significant place. If in the rise of Rome, Athens was still the cultural bedrock of the nation, the intellectual bedrock of everything that went on in the Roman Empire. So what you would have basically had is the Ivy League universities, as they would say in the USA, these high league universities, the Harvards, the Oxfords, and that's all rolled into one, all in Athens. And we still have that idea that philosophy comes from that part of the world. And indeed, that is the case. So to really understand this text, you actually have to have quite an understanding of Greek philosophy and also Greek rhetoric. But today I just want us to actually focus on three points. And let us meditate on these three things. So the first is the problem of culture that we will see. The second is the greatness of God. And the third thing is the outrageousness of the resurrection. And we will see how Paul actually finds himself walking through these steps and actually he's using this rhetoric of the Greeks as well. We will touch on that a little bit. So the first thing we read is, now, in the beginning, we read, Paul reasoned in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him, some of them asking, "What is this babbler trying to say?" We see Paul going here to the marketplace. And the interesting thing is that when we think of marketplace, we think of the spa just here up the road. That's kind of what you hear. But for that society, it was a whole different thing. The word is agora, and it was basically where everything happened. So if you now want the news, you go get a newspaper, you turn on the TV. These days, media is all over the place. You have YouTube. You've got so many resources. But for them, if they wanted the news, they hardly had any books. There was written material, but that was not how things worked. So in this square or marketplace, this agora, there would be a herald, somebody who proclaimed the news all day long. That was his job. That's what he did. So if you wanted the news, you went to the agora. The financial world, if you wanted to do business, if you wanted investors, you would go to this cultural hub. And so the agora is, hence again, it's the center of the financial world for them. If arts were performed, it was in the agora. If there was political or philosophical ideas, if there was anything new to be discussed, it also happened there. And so much more in Athens, who they prided themselves in thinking and in reasoning and thinking about life. So that's the two things that we see. So again, Athens, along with Rome, was the two cultural centers, and it was the cultural centers of cultural centers. The ideas that was forged there and accepted there, that flowed out into the rest of society, and it influenced how people lived and thought in the rest of the Roman Empire. And Paul goes in there. Now notice, we say, he what did he do in the marketplace? He reasoned in the marketplace. Now, the word there is the word dialogume. Now, you might notice it sounds very, very much like this word behind us, dialogue. And that is exactly where we get that word from. Dia is through, and logos, or it's actually legu, means to speak. So it is through speaking. It's dialogue, but not monologue, dialogue. And that's the word. So Paul went into this marketplace, not just in the synagogue. He goes to the center of where life is happening, and there he presents the gospel. So the thing is also, we see this word translated as he reasoned. Why not just dialogue? Why the word reason? And the idea is that it is more than dialogue. Our general idea of it is limited. It is rather more in line with Socratic reasoning. And Socratic reasoning was just not just normal debate. What you would do is you would really listen to someone. You would ask them questions, and that's actually the foremost principle that you'd be using. You'd ask questions and then listen and try to understand their premises, try to understand their point really deeply, and then you try to show them that they are wrong on the basis of their own points. So that is a simplification, but there is a Socratic reasoning. So it has this notion of engagement, that we engage people. And Paul recognizes that the gospel isn't just something that he keeps to himself, that's good for his own personal and private life, but that it is also good for his public life. So he goes to the center of culture, and he gets out the gospel, and which shows that he believes that the gospel has what it takes to challenge the dominant ideas of the time, or of the culture as well. So he's not afraid to use the gospel. He's willing to go toe-to-toe with the elites of society, the real thinkers of society, and he uses the gospel to do that. So what does this mean for us? And the thing is, we are in our jobs, we're in the financial world, we're in the arts world, actually for a very metropolitan city and life and the world that's so open. We're in all these sectors, and yet sometimes we're not quite sure what to do with the gospel in those sectors. And Paul says, don't just preach at people, don't monologue just at people, just don't just throw your ideas right at them. But also don't hide it. Don't hide the gospel. If it is true, then and it has the capacity to stand up to the most rigid and strong ideas that your culture brings forward. And we'll get into that a little bit more. It really gets unpacked in this section. So there's a bit of irony as well if we look back into history. So on our side of history, if we look at this piece, there's irony. And the reason is, what's actually happening is they're mocking Paul, and by the end, they ridicule him even further. And we see this in the section. It says, a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him, and some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Now, the word babbler is the word spermologos, And you might hear the word seed in there. It's a seed picker. And it was an idiom for basically saying somebody speaks nonsense. So he's just picking at nonsense. It was an insult. They say to Paul, you're an intellectual lightweight. You don't belong here. And yet, with Paul speaking, they invite him to the Areopagus. And there he gives his address. So I said there's irony in this piece, and the irony is this, that even though Paul challenged these ideas and they mocked him for it, a couple of hundred years after the fact, Christianity swept over that part of the world, and everyone basically became Christian. And this has puzzled historians and secular historians as well. They're not quite sure how did this happen, because this is Stoicism and Epicureanism has existed for more than 300 years prior to Christ. And it's these high philosophers that take on the gospel. And they laugh it out. They say, what intellectual person would actually take this to be true? I kind of feel this is kind of the pressure that we feel when we try to give our beliefs in our workplace. It's like, you know what, that's cool what you believe, but there's not proper reasons to believe this. Don't come with that. And you get scorned, you get mocked for it. So the extra piece of irony in it is these guys were supposed to be Socratic reasoners. They were supposed to listen and understand, and yet there's a point where they just cut Paul off and they don't listen any further. You maybe ask, okay, so how was it that this gospel, how was it that the words that Paul uses, that it was able to take on that culture? And basically, the answer is this, that all culture has problems, or people have problems and aspirations, and the cultural ideas of the time try to answer those things, sometimes not very well, sometimes not at all. Sometimes we're inconsistent with our beliefs, even Christians. But the fact is, they had answers for the problems that they faced. And Christianity gave a better answer. Paul gave better answers to the dominant cultural ideas. Again, you would ask, okay, now what was those ideas? How was it that Paul challenged these things? The hint in the text, and I've already mentioned them, is the Epicureans and the Stoics. So Paul reasoned with these two groups. And who were the Epicureans and the Stoics? Now, I'm going to overgeneralize. I watched a few lectures from Yale on Stoicism and Epicureanism, and it's just a rabbit hole that never ends. It will take you a long time to really get to the depth of it, or through it. So what we will try to do is just try and capture how they defined the meaning of life, these two groups. How do you find meaning in life? This is the Epicureans and the Stoics. So for the Stoics, they believed meaning in life was to be found to be good and virtuous and noble and courageous. It was a particular view that they had that the meaning of life is found that you shouldn't let life get to you. And we can kind of hear that from the text or from the word Stoic. If we hear someone is a Stoic, we hear, that they're not fazed by life. And this is actually, it's getting a bit of a resurgence, I think, especially in Europe, this Stoicism and how to practice it. Marcus Aurelius, a few hundred years after Christ, who is supposed the emperor of emperors in the Roman Empire, he is one of the main proponents also in saying this is how you live a good life. But the fact is, this was basically almost impossible. Historians note that for the common person, it is impossible to just say, you know what, I'm just going to suck it up and live through it, and life is not going to faze me. And even for the Stoics, they said, among themselves, nobody is actually a Stoic, because you would have to be a god, a demigod, But the best we do is we pursue this path because this will give you happiness. If you're diligent, if you do what's right, that's the best chance that you have at happiness. Now, what is the weakness in this? What was Christianity's answer? And the Christian answer is basically hope and resurrection. It said we do not function because we are strong, because in actual fact, we struggle to be strong. And so Christians lived better. They suffer better. Christians have the capacity to know whatever happens here, this isn't it. There's more. Christians died better. And maybe something of this first ideas of the gospel, we might have lost it. Paul had it. Because Paul was willing to go through persecution. When he just comes into Athens, he was basically just thrown in prison, beaten. He fled from Philippi to Thessalonica. And there the Jews persecuted him, so much so that he fled to Berea. He finds some rest there. But then the Jews from Thessalonica came to persecute him even further. And so they snuck him out at night. And he comes to Athens, tired. He has nobody with him. He has every reason. If you do your job, and you know you've got a mission, you have something to do. But if your resource is kind of depleted and you have to wait for the reinforcements to come, the natural thing for you to do is just take a bit of a breather, you know, take some stock, just reset a little bit. But Paul is so convinced, he's so torn apart by seeing how these Greeks live that he cannot do any other but go in and debate with them, go in and take the gospel. He's so convinced of this gospel truth. And so he takes it there. The Epicureans, on the other hand, how did they define what is the good life or the meaning of life? Now, they were basically atheists. They acknowledged the gods, but they really said these Greek gods there's not really an afterlife. They didn't believe in an afterlife. These Greek gods won't help you much. So their meaning was found not in to be virtuous and good, but rather to be happy. So if you're going to struggle, if you're going to suffer, if you're in any case going to die, you might as well just enjoy it. That's an oversimplification. But they really believed in this freedom that you should live your life the way you want. And the way to find happiness is just pursue what makes you happy. So, of course, there was limits. If you had a drinking night, there's consequences. But on this topic, they also had a lot to say about sexual freedom. You know, enjoy life. Don't let it get in the way. And what's interesting, again, the historians ask, now, how was Christianity able to challenge this cultural view? How did it win out over this? So, especially if you think that the Christian idea of sex is, on surface level, more restrictive. It doesn't quite sound like this is the way to go. But the funny thing is, if you pursue sex for happiness, you end up lonely and empty. And I'm not sure if any of you had friends like this, or not necessarily Christian. I would hope not Christian. But just kind of, I know this pilot, he has a very nice job, or had a nice job before Corona. Actually, he's still doing quite all right. And he basically, I know the guy who sits with him in the airplane. And he basically just comes into the cockpit and brags every day about his 5 girlfriends. And they kind of know about each other. But that's the good life. That's how you live life. You just have to, you know, how beautiful these women are, and that's just perfect. So, in a certain sense, we still have our Epicureans today, chasing meaning of life through what makes us happy. And the Christian answer just says, well, that just leads to loneliness and emptiness. But in the long run, to pursue the right way of sex will lead to a deeper unity in your relationships, and it will give fulfillment. It will give true meaning. And it is interesting. It's, again, our modern culture, our modern sensibilities is challenging this idea again. And it says Christianity is so backwards. Get with the program. This is you're old school on how you think about sex. If you come up just here past Magnolia Doll, there's an LGBT flag hanging there. If you watched the rugby last night, you'd see, I think it's Gay Pride Month. So it's something that the world, this worldview is challenging. Just let people be happy. Just let them be happy. It's not necessarily everything wrong with that. And I can see where they come from. It doesn't mean we need to be prunes about it. But the fact is, that doesn't lead to joy. It doesn't lead to meaning. It leads to emptiness and loneliness. That's why the Christian worldview won out. So if someone says to you that Christianity should get with the program, this is old ideas, actually, we've already been in such a culture in the past. This is how the Greeks saw the world. And we won out over that. We've been there. We've gotten the T-shirt. And it's just a resurgence of what's happening in life. So again, if we look at the Stoics believed in moral absolutes. They called this moral absolutes the logos. And this logos, it's with a capital L. It means more than what you just think. It's also where we get the word logic from. But the idea is that there's an expectation that there's a rational structure behind the universe. There is meaning to be found. And one of the clues is morality. So therefore, they believed if you live a good life, we see something of a return on that. We see a life that has some fulfillment. But they basically said, it's a very Platonian way. It's like you have to think deeply on life. You have to be a philosopher. You have to be the philosopher. And then you can kind of figure out what is good and what is right, and you can figure out what is meaningful. So Christianity acknowledged this to a certain extent. They said, yes, there is a logos. There is structure to the universe. There is meaning. But it is not just in high-minded intellectualism. It is not in just thinking. And many of us, we speak with dead people. We read our books. They're dead. But actually, you really find meaning in your relationships, living people. What's your book if you can, if it has no, it carries no worth into the rest of your life, into the rest of your relationships, if you don't discuss it with anyone, if there's no implication. And so the Christian view says that the logos is this structure behind the universe, this meaning, this morality. It's there, but it's a person. It's a kicker. It's Jesus Christ. I think we're like fish in water again. We don't know what it is to be wet. We're so used to this God idea, and he's supposedly our friend. And of course, we have our we can engage with the world and wisdom. But if we think about it, if the meaning of life is to be found in relationship with God, it is the Creator. You get to have conversation with the God that created everything. And this is what Paul is putting forward. This is the gospel. So the Stoics believed that in moral absolutes, but they were called. The Epicureans said you could live any way you want, but it was empty and lonely. And Christianity said there is moral absolutes, but the way you get it is to have relationship with Christ. This is basically the idea that Paul brought into this. This context, and we will see closer how he does that. So this is also how you do it. If you have to challenge your culture, and the cultural ideas of your time. I think one of the problems we have is we've got morality. There's a lot of moral talk, justice, social justice. This critical theory has a lot to say about justice. But the fact is we don't have any basis for that. And I think we'll get to that a little bit later again. So this is the first point I wanted to make, the problem with culture. The second point is the greatness of God. And now we kind of, Paul gets out of the marketplace. He goes to the Areopagus. I can't say it. I'll get you on to fix it later on. This is basically, I'm just going to translate, Ares. So who of you knows, who've played the game God of War? Who knows about it? Nobody. So there it is. So Greek culture is still well and alive. We're quite familiar with it in broad strokes. And so this hill is named the hill for Ares. And it was basically a court. N.T. Wright notes it wasn't just the common philosophy that happened there. It was just the highest of cases that was taken there. And Paul gets an invite to give an address here at the at this place, Mars Hill. That will help me. We'll go with Mars Hill. Mars is also Aries, so hence we get that. And what does Paul do? Well, basically the heart of his argument is he shows them that God is great. God is bigger. He's bigger than they even imagined him to be. So he doesn't just do it because he thinks it's a nice idea. There's method in the madness. He follows the structure. So the reason for that is because the place was rife with idols. You had Ares, Athens is named after Athena, you had Poseidon, you had all these gods. But these gods, they were irritable. They had their emotions hurt. They backstabbed one another. They were egocentric. They weren't really gods if you think about it. They were us, just with superpowers. They were just strong. And I think there's something in our modern context that we see. This whole Marvel phenomena, the superhero thing, they didn't even try to hide it. They put four right in it. It's basically you, but more beautiful and with more power. So I think that's what we kind of grab onto when we watch these type of movies. I think there's something in our romantic comedies and all of those things as well. It's a life that we wish we kind of can live, that we can experience, these gods. These gods were made in their image. It was basically humans. The interesting thing as well on this is that they didn't necessarily love these gods. They needed to appease them. If you would go on an ocean voyage, the sea is a scary place. It's been that way and it's still that way. You would reach out to Poseidon and just beg him, keep me on this journey, and you'll sacrifice a few things, and then you hope that that Poseidon will look after you. But Paul now, this is what Paul is doing. You see the reasoning of Paul? He's trying to get to show them, listen here, you think there's something bigger than these gods. There's a hint for you that there's something bigger. And this is how he does it. We read verse 22. Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with an inscription to the unknown God. And we're not really sure. Luke, who writes this, doesn't really tell us more about this. But it could have been a polytheist, one of these guys who just follow all of these gods. And he's so afraid, he's just doing his due diligence. He's so afraid he's offending one of the gods. And so he erects or sets up this altar to the unknown God, just in case we missed one, that he doesn't struck us down, that he is also appeased. But we don't really know that. What we do know is what Paul saw, and Paul saw a sign, a symbol, and that symbol is he saw expectation that They expect a God, but they don't know him. They don't fully know him. They expect him to be there, but they don't know about him. And Paul says, I will show you this God. And then it is how he goes about that. So that's going to be verse 24 to verse 26. And verse 27 says, the text goes on. So how does he do it? He says in verse 24, "The God who made the world and everything in it, being the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man." Verse 25, "Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything." So his first point is God is much bigger than any of the gods that they have. He's not caught in one of these temples or the stone or gold. And we'll see that later on. It gets repeated. He's bigger than that. And also he's not sufficient or he's self-sufficient. He doesn't need humans to bring him anything. He's beginningless and he's endless. He's trying to give them this big God. And I think it would do us well to meditate on that. I think actually the fight between Calvinism or Arminianism, I don't want to get too much into that, but I'll just say there might be something there on how big God is and just realizing he's outside of your understanding. So he starts to point people into this direction of a big God. The third thing he does is he says this God is sovereign over everything. He says it in verse 26. "He has not only made all the nations, but he has marked out, he has determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place." He's basically saying that everything that happens in history is under his control. He has created everything, and he is dependent on nothing. And then he says the following thing in verse 27. He says that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each of us. And the thing is there, so he first gave him this big God, and now he says, but this God wants a relationship with you. He wants to be found. He wants fellowship. He wants relationship. Paul is hinting them in that direction. And the way he grounds it is brilliant. It's verse 28. He quotes their philosophers and poets. It reads, "In him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring." There's two quotes there. The first, we're not quite sure from who that is. They think it might be from a philosopher in Crete. But the second is Aratus, and he was in the 4th or 3rd century before Christ. He wrote in Macedonia. He is a father of much of the philosophy that these people hold on to. And they would know these words. In him we live and move and have our being. It basically says he's saying your own philosophers has posited this, and the God who is great that holds up everything and every second, we live and move and have our being. This is a continuous state that God is even in control of that. And the second thing he says is, "For we are indeed his offspring." And so they acknowledge that they are created. They are created by a God. And actually, if you read the poem, it points to Zeus. But there's this expectation that they are created. There's a hint for them that they are created. And why this is so brilliant is because Paul is using Socratic reasoning here. He's not using his argument. He's using their arguments. He's using their writers. He's using their poets. It's their ideas. It's not his. And what Paul then is doing is he's not saying that I will prove to you that God exists. He says, I will prove to you that you already know this God. This is the line of reasoning that Paul is trying to follow or to take down, take us down and take them down. And if you really follow that, this is brilliant logically. And what he's saying is, it is in their own writings, it's in their own thinking, it's in their behavior, the way they worship. They expect morality. They want this God. And they don't know him fully, but then they know he's there. So that's the argument there. And maybe to root it, what would that look for our modern sentiment? Or, you know, I kind of tried to show us how Paul did that for the Greeks. But for us as moderns, I think this is a good story. There was this cultural anthropologist, and she did studies in Africa. But at some point, she got really offended by how women were treated in some of these cultures. And so she went to the people in authority in those cultures, and she asked, she pointed out, this is wrong. And they said to her, don't you impose your white Western individualistic values on us? And so she was quite offended by that, not just intellectually, but emotionally. And she walked away and thought about that. She wrote an article on this, and this is kind of how we have all of that. And the thing is, she realized she has beliefs, but she's not a Christian. She doesn't believe in any God. She's secular. And she realized, well, I've got beliefs, and you've got beliefs, and I'm telling you why I feel the way I do, that this is wrong. I'm pretty sure this is wrong. But I've got no grounding to say your culture, my culture, which one is right. If everything is, if you perceive it to be good, who am I to say that you are wrong? So she acknowledges that she has beliefs. And the thing is, we can equate for feelings of morality, of what is right and wrong. We can do that through evolution, evolutionary theory, we can say, because your parents were right is loving people and wrong is abusing people. And the people who loved people, they actually survived, and that gene got carried on. And therefore, you have these feelings about what you perceive to be right. But it's actually just feelings. It's your history tricking yourself that this is actually meaningful. But we don't have, from that worldview, we don't have a moral obligation. We just have this feeling. Who is she to tell these people that their way of doing things is wrong? And so she concludes in the article, because she said she couldn't stop. She couldn't stop believing that these women's rights needs to be protected. Let me just get the piece. I just want to read what she says here. Well, it basically comes down, I can read it. She says, because I am a secular person, I have absolutely no right to impose my Western values on them. And yet, I have to believe that equal rights for women is universally true. I have no basis for it, but I feel that way. And therefore, even though I have no basis for it, I'm going to work for equal rights in Africa. She says she's just going to continue the work. And Paul is basically then, what Paul would have said to her, is her working for women's rights in Africa is an altar to the unknown God. She expects that there is an absolute truth and an absolute right and wrong, and she's going to act on that. So he's saying that she believes it in her actions. Her actions betray herself, but she doesn't acknowledge him. And that's kind of, I think, how it plays out for our modern context. It's something that we can challenge our modern context with. So the thing is, so Paul gave these reasons, and then he steps a bit away from their argument, and he introduces some Jewish ideas or new ideas, and he speaks about God as a man and the resurrection. And the moment he does that, he gets interrupted. He gets cut off. He doesn't even get to say Christ's name. He was just speaking about this man that God has sent. And then he gets cut off. Now, why is this so challenging for people? Why is this so outrageous? And the reason is the natural order works. Things decay, things die. The resurrection doesn't happen. People don't get out of the grave. And it's unbelievable, except that it is true. That's Paul's point. He says, the proof that I give you, so after I've made this known to you, you know this God. After Paul shows us that, he says, this God now puts a claim on your life. He says, repent, turn to me, turn to this meaning, to this relationship. And a judgment day is coming. And there's a resurrection. And the resurrection, he gives us a proof for this judgment day. These guys didn't believe in the afterlife. And yet I think it is the biggest problem that they faced. The Stoics and the Epicureans, both of them were basically atheists. The Epicureans especially so. The Stoics were more agnostic. They didn't have a fixed idea of the afterlife. So the Epicureans would say, you know, we're going to die, so while we're here, we might as well enjoy it. And the Stoics said, well, we're only here for a little bit, so while we're here, we must make it count. But they didn't have an answer for death. And this is something that Albert Camus says. He creates this thought experiment where he says, okay, what do you like in life? Do you like your cricket? Do you like a nice braai? What do you like? And then he says, I'll give it to you. But I've got a gun and I'm going to kill you in an hour. So I'm just going to leave you with that. There's your cricket and your braai or whatever you like. And what does that leave you with? You can either ignore this imminent death, or you can try and enjoy whatever you're doing, but knowing that it is semi-meaningless, this game that you're going to watch now. Suddenly it's not so enjoyable anymore. There's a lack of meaning. And he states that life is a gun to your head. Death is imminent. It is coming. So whether it's an hour or 80 years, death is coming. This is our biggest problem. And I think this is ultimately Paul's argument as well, where he speaks into that culture and says, your biggest problem is that you're looking for meaning, but you know it is all meaningless if everything comes to an end. And Paul says, there's a resurrection. There is a hope. And it is on that conviction that he is willing again to go into this culture. If we get any of these points, if we're convinced by the gospel, then I think we can stand out and walk into difficult spaces and testify and give the gospel as a reason and not just a superficial gospel. Really get into, understand where people are coming from. Ask them questions. Have dialogue with people. Get to know them. Don't just give a superficial answer. Recognize when there's some truth. The LGBT thing. There's justice. They cry out for people that you just hated. Try and understand a little bit of that worldview and then speak into it from your Christian perspective, from the knowledge that you have of morality. So that is what I have for us today. I would like to pray for us, and then maybe there's some time for Q&A. Father, thank you that you are bigger than what we think, and sometimes we create you in our image, and then we are disappointed when you don't live up to that. But Father, help us to see you for who you really are. Help us see your fingerprints all over our own lives in a personal and deep sense. Give us that conviction. And Father, thank you that you're personal, that you allow us into your kingdom, that you see us as children. And if we would only reach out and seek you, we can find you. Father, help us to to really see past all our modern sensibilities and troubles and even what we value, and that we just tear away all the muck and just see that there is nothing without your cross and the death that you had to pay for our sins, Father, so that we can have a life, we can have a resurrection. And Father, yeah, strengthen us, remind us so that we are zealous, that we want to go out, that we are not afraid, but that we know that the gospel has what it takes to challenge modern and prominent ideas, cultural strongholds, that we can speak into that. Amen.